Okay, so welcome back, and we were just getting ready to talk a little bit about the laundry.
My earliest memory of the laundry is when my grandmother worked there, and
Your grandmother,
my grandmother
Vera?
Vera Ingeson, and grandma worked there, doing the laundry, washing the bedding and clothing for the static employees that didn't live outside of the cannery, who'd come in, and the general workforce. One day, my mother brought me down because grandma had invited us down, and there used to be this big, I call it a wooden barrel almost. It was a big washing machine. It was like there was a big wooden tank that spun. And there were these big open doors, and I remember she filled it up, and I got to go swimming in this washing machine. Well, that was part of a tradition, I guess. And a lot of my cousins and friends from other families remember doing the same thing. It was sort of a tradition for us younger kids.
Well, you swam in the washing machine, and I swam in the fish bins.
Right. Well, there's the one big, we called it the hot tub, right? Behind the ice house there.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Big old cedar.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember too, with the washing machine, it had a clutch, and you needed to shift it.
Oh my
But that thing
gosh.
could wash something like 40 wool blankets
Oh my
in
God. Can you
one.
imagine how heavy that must have got?
Yeah. Extraordinary.
Well,
So, I was going to say, so Vera worked in the cannery and not just kind of entered it, but she ran that laundry. And it seemed like that would became a tradition where you had the local community kind of moving into the workforce through the laundry, and particularly women.
sure,
Yeah.
I can see that.
Yeah.
My grandfather was a plumber. Remember Charlie Savo? Yeah, he was a spring and fall time
Yep.
plumber too. Nick Pete.
Yep.
My grandfather was part of that crew that'd go there and they'd connect the pipes, connect the pipeline, and break it apart when it was time to go, time to close up.
So you talked a little bit about the store. So that was one of my very first memories, was the store, because that was my dad's first job, was
Starkeep.
to be the storekeeper. He worked down in Ugashik and some of the other canneries too. But I have a very vague memory of the store. Do you have any? Can you describe the store?
So the store, it has evolved significantly, how they managed it from our time there to how it's managed now. Fishermen had a provisions warehouse where they would put their food orders in, and people would stock their food orders for them. So Judy Gherkin, Gherke, is it
Turkey, yep.
Gherke? Judy Gherke and Frank, oh gosh, what's Frank's last
I can't
name?
remember.
Devona's husband.
Yeah.
Judy and Frank would.
Hanson or well, anyway, go ahead.
They would put the grub orders together, and then you'd go over to the store, and the store it was just really a place for just the general dry goods and stuff.
And was the store, you're imagining the store as in the big warehouse
No,
that became the Red Pump?
no, yeah, up
Right.
across from the office there.
Yeah.
So I can remember when Allison Davis and her family worked there because Clyde's wife was,
Shelley.
Clyde and Shelley. Clyde was a watchman, and I think Allison was her sister, right? Allison and Jared, Shelley's brother and sister. And Allison worked there at the store, and that's growing up later. I'd say in my late teen years, early adulthood. When I remember when they transitioned away from that and brought it down to where the cook hall is, the mess hall is. So they, where the new store is at now, and I call it the new store. I don't even know if it operates anymore, but I remember that was the mess hall area for, like the operation executive management of the.
The blue room
Yeah.
and the yellow room, and
Yeah.
then you had the big
Yeah, and then we're, you know, we're the laborers and then the fishermen, mm-hmm. you know. And I remember that place would be packed, you know, early summer and through the summer. I mean, you'd have to eat in shifts, mm-hmm. you know. And if you were lucky, you got a seat at the end of the mess hall, you know, over the course of the last 20 years or so, in its decline. I mean, it's so different now, mm-hmm. you know, they cordon it off now and there's only like a couple of tables right. that they open up now.
Yeah, could you used to be able to feed, what, 500-600 people easy. 7 times a day?
Easy.
So about that time too, in the early 70s, or late 70s actually, they still had the Filipino mess
mm-hmm.
that was connected. Do you remember that?
I remember when the Filipino cook hall was up in one of the bunkhouses.
Mm.
Do you recall that?
Mm-mm. No.
Okay, it was the one that was... it was close to the tanks,
mm-hmm.
or was that the Italian cookhouse?
There was a cookhouse up there.
Yeah,
oh, I didn't know that.
Well, no, it was a bunkhouse yeah. that was outfitted with stoves and, you know, cooking.
It wasn't the one, the Filipino mess hall next to the mess hall, right over here.
No,
it was up here somewhere, huh?
Yeah. So there was a Filipino bunkhouse and an Italian bunkhouse.
Uh huh.
And I recall even up until, the later years, there were still elements of the Italian, you know, cook mess hall up in that bunkhouse there.
So it was in that open space, probably
yeah.
in
the common area.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think Dad shut that down because of fire
mm-hmm.
fear, and I think that's about the same time he integrated the mess hall, so no longer this, because he segregated before the law passed.
Wow.
Yeah. And again, it was good business, and mm-hmm. you know, opposed to, you know,
oh,
but
yeah,
yeah. So canneries were segregated. Did you have any kind of experience with any kind of segregation?
Well, you know, there, yeah, I think that there was an informal, unspoken form of it growing up. You know, there was the local, the local element, right? And then the out-of-state workers would come in and sort of just take over. And I remember David Hodgson had this sentiment where, you know, he just really had a lot, he had just taste for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because all that hard work that he put forth to get it all ready, and people would come in. We're not talking about the cannery workers. We're talking about the summer beach gang crew,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they'd come in and just sort of take over. And it
yeah.
just, it always rubbed him wrong, you know. To me, it wasn't a big deal because I was evolving and integrating, you know, socially into the mix. I was coming into my early 20s.
Sure.
And, you know, I absolutely looked forward to going back to the cannery after, you know, college would get out. And that was part of my deal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just loved it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I came of age in a cannery. My first experiences were in a cannery, for crying out loud. I mean, that's probably not a good thing, but, you know, it's, you know, how I came into being. You know, a lot of people don't get those experiences until they, you know, break away from the nest and go to college. Well, I had those experiences at 13,
mm-hmm.
you know, and just incredible. I mean, just everything about it. I mean, the city of the cannery. I mean, it was a city,
mm-hmm.
really. It was its own community. And there were so many different cultures there and so many different you know, types of people, the California kids that would come in,
mm-hmm.
and you know, the Filipino mm-hmm. processors that still came in,
yeah.
even though they, you know, they were integrated, they, you know, they'd still come in and as their own group.
Mm-hmm. Japanese technicians.
Yeah, yeah.
Scandinavian crew, the Italian, Croatians.
The Croatians.
Yeah,
yeah, you bet.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just even though there was. You know, segregation was, you know, largely stamped out, you know, socially, the footprint of that still existed.
Sure.
And, You know, I would like to say that I enjoyed, you know, very multi-ethnic upbringing in the cannery.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, I could go home and, you know, live with my grandma and grandpa, and then I get to go down and, you know, work in the cannery and just be exposed to all types of lifestyles and,
yeah,
and everything. I mean, it was a huge educational experience for me, probably the most profound, because I was exposed to so many, you know, so many different ways of life, so many different thought processes. I know that that has influenced how I am today,
mm-hmm,
you know, in large part because it was its own world,
mm-hmm,
you know, and you had to coexist in the world.
Yeah.
You couldn't fight against it. You know, you just wouldn't have survived or done well.
Mm-hmm.
And I just enjoyed very much the ability to come back for, you know, the 5 or 6 years that I got to work there, you know, a very short amount of time, not very much time at all, but, you know, just integrating into that workforce. So there's that time that I have there. And then my time as a fisherman, which
right,
is lifelong.
Yeah.
You know, and those two are connected. Very much so.
How so?
Well, it's, you know, the location. The commonality of the cannery brings it all together.
Mm-hmm.
So it's home. It mm-hmm really is. I will always know and say that South Naknek is my home, even though I might live here. And when I say that that's my home, you know, two places stand out to me. One, my grandma's big greenhouse up in the middle of the village, mm-hmm, in the cannery. Two places that I absolutely have to go. Oh, and the old Orthodox church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just part of who I am. And
even when you're out on the water,
mm-hmm,
you can see it.
You can. Growing up fishing with my dad, we had the old Homeward, which is now the Kimmy. It's a little fiberglass boat. And I grew up on that boat there. My dad fished a number of company boats before then. Pen 4 when he fished with Peter Pan. He had NN58 when he fished for APA. CWF when he fished for Bumblebee, which was an old little bow picker. And in my time, we had the Homeward, which was an old fiberglass boat. And I was telling you this the other day. You know, one of the most distinguishing features of the cannery is not when you're within the cannery itself, but when you're miles out on the water and you could see the light of the egg house in the middle of the night, and especially during a rough storm. I mean, that's almost like a beacon. You know, it was a sense of security as a kid for me. The glow of that orange glow, that amber glow that just sort of lit up, you know, and you could see that from way out the Y, out in the Naknek district. And I just have a very, I remember one night, it was just a really crappy weather, you know, really rough. And we're out in the back of the stern and fishing wasn't really good. And I was just miserable and tired. And I remember looking up and seeing the cannery all lit up, you know, it was miles away from where I was, but it was just, you know, just a fantastic sight to see, really. I mean, it was a sense of security, I suppose. That lighthouse effect, you know, when you actually see the light at the end of the tunnel and you know that at the end of the day, you're going to be able to go home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do you remember when you come into the cannery, or, you know, let's say they have a closure, you come in for the day, you go into the mess hall, all that food.
So do you remember it on the creek side of the cannery, the upriver side, when they used to put the scows out, the flat barges? Okay, so that was like a little harbor. It was like a little port in there.
Hmm.
And they stopped doing that years ago. And during closures, people would tie up to those flat scows. And, you know, the general rule of thumb is when you're on a boat, you stay on the boat until the boat goes dry. So that was its own community there. So you tie up, mm-hmm, and everybody, you know, especially on a nice day, you'd go out and everybody'd be on their decks, everybody'd be talking. You know, it was just sort of like leaning over the fence in your backyard talking to your neighbor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, then the boat would go dry and then you'd go up and you know, resupply and get ready for the next opener, or go to the bar, mm-hmm. you know, and you know, just a little bit of R&R went a long way.
Yeah.
I'm talking rest and relaxation. Yeah. You know, just to be able to clear your mind and go to the cannery. You know, with commercial fishing, especially bay fishing, we try to squeeze in a year's worth of income into a couple of short weeks.
Yeah.
And sometimes we can do it. Sometimes you can't. A lot of times we can't. And the amount of effort and labor that goes into that is just all-consuming and physically exhausting.
Yeah.
So you don't take things for granted, like going into the cannery on a closure to go and grub up, or you know, get your case of pop or your can of coffee or your, you know, your fresh cookies from Jolona or whatever. You know, you don't take those things lightly. You don't take them for granted, because those are treasures. You know, really, and that's part of, you know, part of what I identify with. And the cannery was sort of a breadbasket, not just, you know, for, you know, social, you know, thriving socially, but, you know, for general sustenance. You know, you needed that sense of security. It was almost a very nurturing type of element. And I knew that, you know, when we'd go into the cannery, when we'd have time, that was home to me. You know, in addition to being, you know, my grandmother's house,
right.
I spent the majority of my time at the cannery.
When I say mug up, what comes to mind?
Coffee time and socializing. Yeah. And fresh maple bars and cookies.
What do you see when you just imagine mug up? What's going on? What's the scene look like?
Okay. What I see, when I think of mug up, I think everybody's sitting on the bull rail in front of the Beach Gang office, you know, right outside of where the mug up room is now,
mm-hmm.
and everybody lined up and, you know, sitting back, you know, just enjoying time. You know, 15 minutes goes a long way.
Yeah.
You know, when you're tired and you're exhausted or maybe you're just not having a good day, you know, that's soulless, you know, just, 15-minute cup of coffee can go a long way when you're a laborer and mm-hmm. when you're a fisherman. Yeah, and that's what comes to mind. You know, it's just a, you know, that moment where you actually get to let go and unwind and maybe forget about where you're at. You know, a lot of people detested being back there in the bay, and I could never figure that out because I absolutely loved it. I mean, when I got to go back to the cannery, I mean, I was at home and I felt at home. And, you know, you'd hear occasional fishermen gripe about, you know, wanting to go home, or, you know, they only come here to fish and then they go and can't wait to leave. I could never get that.
I never remember the work.
No.
When they tell the stories, no one ever talks about the work.
Yeah. I had some great experiences there. You know, I talk about, you know, working with David on the Beach Gang. My first job, I worked with Bob McTeever was my supervisor. Bob asked me, pulled me aside, and goes, "Kid, why do you want to work here?" It was like a test, you know. And I was like, I gave him this philosophical, profound answer, and he was like, "Well, you're going to go work with Eric in the pipe shop, and you're going to be a plumber for the, your grandpa was a plumber, so you're going to be a plumber." And I had to go be a plumber with, do you remember Eric, the Filipino guy? He was a, mm-hmm. okay. I had to work with him and this other guy named Eric, and they were Eric and Eric. And it was hilarious. They were like Eric was Filipino. One Eric was Filipino. The other guy was like Midwestern, you know, it was like, two totally different people, and you know, Laurel and Hardy types, you know, working with these two clowns, and they made that first work season just incredibly fun. Yeah,
I think what you said about how, you know, because of that experience, you know, it's funny because when I grew up in a small town in Washington, and people would be like, "Oh, you're going to Alaska, you're going to the end of the earth." But in reality, we were going to one of the most cosmopolitan places that you could ever, you know, recreate. Mm-hmm. I mean, you compared it to New York City. And I think for me, looking back, as this project has given me that opportunity, it's those years, those summers that I think shaped who I am.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not necessarily my academic background, but it was being able to work with people who are completely different than me, mm-hmm. and doing it, working it out. And I think that's extraordinary.
It is. It's certainly shaped who I am and how I work today. Because, you know, my grandmother, likely the greatest influence of my, you know, my not just my professional career, but, you know, everything that I own, I attribute to my grandmother. When I was at a really young age, my parents sent me to a set net for her. I think it was like 5 years old. And at 5 years old, you can't do much, you know, but you could pack fish.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, we would manually pack the fish up, you know, from the beach up to the rocks, where the set net or the beach trucks would come down from Bumblebee, and they would pew fish into the back of the trucks.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, going from, you know, the womb of my home in Anchorage into that alien environment of labor was really, really difficult for me that first year. But after that, my grandmother, she ran her set-net operation like a military operation, perfectly, with perfect precision. And that's how she ran things. She was tough. And you knew it, you know. And then she'd have these moments of tenderness that would melt all of that and made it all incredibly worth it. I remember, you know, I remember hating it, you know. And then at the end of the season, my grandmother handed me a check. And she says, "You earned every bit of it," you know, and gave me a big hug. And it was just like, oh, my God. It was my first big paycheck, you know, at 12 years old. I earned a couple thousand dollars, and I understood then that, you know, you reap what you sow. You know, it was a valuable lesson that my grandmother taught me. The harder you work, the more you gain, and that's how she raised her family. She didn't raise children for the sake of having kids. She raised kids for the sake of contributing to the economy of the family.
Right.
That's why they had 10 kids. And all of that was targeted, you know, to the cannery's workforce.
Mm-hmm.
You think about it.
Yeah.
You know, the fishing industry.
Yep. And so what would be kind of your final thoughts on the relationship between the local community and the cannery?
Almost as if it's the life of the community, really. A lot of things. South Natick, I believe, was born from the cannery. Naturally, I mean, South Natick is the result of you know, natural disaster, the eruption of Nova Rupta,
mm-hmm.
1912, and then you know, compounded with the pandemic of 1919, you know, and people migrated to where the economy was,
mm-hmm.
and it was an evolving era, you know, back turn of the century. From the turn of the century to the 1950s was an era of adaptation, and then from the 1950s to present day, you know, the advent of modern technology to now, just in the last 46 years that I participated in the fishery, the advancements have been just incredible. You know, you think about this. When I was, you know, 12 and 13 years old fishing on my dad's boat as a crewman, I'd always gone out with my dad, you know, from the age of three on. I'd go out on the boat with him. There were a couple years where I fished with my grandmother, but from the age of 12 on, I was an actual employee of my dad's. You know, that's when he actually began to compensate me and pay me as a crewman. But, you know, watching how the fishery evolved from these old wooden boats, you know, to the modern technology that we have today, I spent a ton of money on my boat last year into the general radio technology for my boat, the electronics, the sonar, and the radio communications, all in secret. You know, like we've got secret coded radios now, and you know, my great grandfather didn't have that when he fished in a sailboat. You know, they oared out if there wasn't any wind. You know, maybe they got a tow from the monkey boat. They called it the monkey boat, and you know, just a totally different era and lifestyle from the 1950s to modern day Bristol Bay now. It's a totally different world. You know, what kills me about that, Katie, is that many local people can't compete with the advancements of technology because it's so expensive.
Yeah.
So those who have secondary careers or primary careers, because fishing may only be maybe just a hobby or a way to spend money so you have a good tax benefit, you know, are flush with money so that they can invest into technologically advanced fishing vessels. They're a lot faster, they pack a lot more, and they just, you know, edge the competition out, really. They're constructed and made to be superior,
right,
you know, to edge out the competition. And the little guy that's coming in with the little fiberglass boat from the village of, you know, Clark's Point, yeah, or, you know, wherever, those people are gonna have a hard time.
Yeah.
Because they don't have the resources to keep up with that. You know, I I was down in Niggigig last summer, and I was sitting there and, you know, trying to compete with everybody else on the line, and it was incredibly frustrating day because there wasn't a lot of fish. So I decided to go in river, and you know, I came across a local that was, I mean, nailing him, man. He was by himself. All the other guys, like myself, all the dummies, were out in the line, you know, banging boats and, you know, wasting fuel and trying to earn a buck. And here we had this guy in the river. I just came up on him and I was like, his net's going to town, man. He's been doing this all day. And you know, the local knowledge, you know, it somehow is just enough to, you know, maintain the thread of life into the industry. We know, you know, just through general statistical tracking of permits managed by the Limited Entry Commission, that more people out of state own Alaska or Bristol Bay permits than Alaska residents. Even fewer Bristol Bay residents own permits than, right, you know, what was intended for when it was created, unfortunately.
And I imagine too that the closure of this cannery is kind of a big representation, the end of the era.
It is the end of an era, and it's really sad because the closing of the cannery has also had what I consider to be a very profound impact on the community of South Naknek. South Naknek is where I come from, and I remember as a child, you know, the year-round population was rather healthy, 150, 200 people lived there. But even the village, you heard life in the village, whether it be a four- or three-wheeler cruising up the road, or, you know, the Holstrom's chopping wood or chainsawing steam bath wood, you know, or, you know, cutting up smokehouse wood. I mean, there was always life in the community. Well, you know, since the cannery shut down, I mean, you know, the village of South Naknek is you know, it's emaciated.
Right.
It's gotten to a point to where I know that it's likely just a matter of time before, you know, we write the history on South Naknek because it's become abandoned, like what's happened in Ugashik.
Yeah.
Ugashik at one time was a community like South Naknek,
mm-hmm,
but they had a cannery. And now, you know, we've got one shareholder left in the village of Ugashik.
Yeah.
One guy, and he's 82 years old. We're watching history unfold there, you know, and it's just a matter of time before the inevitable happens and that's sealed. And that's unfortunate, but we're watching that happen with South Naknek too.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of that is, you know, economically related. And that's how significant this, you know, this facility has been on the community.
So in terms of kind of your perspective looking back, going from a child to teenager to a young person in their 20s, 30s, and now is in your position now looking back and considering this project, why do you think it's important to preserve this history, the history of the canneries, the history of the people who work there, and what advice or what would you want to remind us as we go forward?
History is important because, you know, we need to record the history and the general record of those who were really brought forth by the cannery, not just the outsiders that came in and contributed to the general workforce, but, you know, the actual community, you know, the integration that was allowed to happen. Your father was obviously instrumental in that because he allowed the local workforce to participate in the Fall and the Spring crew. My fondest memories are being able to go to work for Trident, you know, earn my keep, so to speak. My grandmother would have used that term, earn your keep, you know, so we did. And I just have the greatest sense of appreciation for what I was able to gain from those experiences at this particular cannery, from this industry. The commercial fish industry is brutal. It really is. One, because it's really based on a sense of do or die competition. You know, it's really, I liken it to my crew every year when I'm bringing a new crew onto my boat. You know, I tell them it's like you're in a vacuum tube with a bunch of dollars flying around, and whoever grabs the dollars the fastest is the ones that win. And if you're slow and you don't grab the dollars fast enough, I mean, you're SOL. And I would say that element has really enabled me, one, to apply those general values and standards away from the fishery to what I do now. Fishing is not my primary source of income any longer. It's more of a tradition than it is anything else. My son's a fifth generation Bristol Bay fisherman. I'm very proud of that. My great-grandfather and my grandfather fished on sailboats. My father fished on a conversion boat, an old company boat. And, he's able to participate, and he's fished on my boat, which the new Homeward, which is a big aluminum boat now. And we've got, you know, five generations of commercial fishermen born out of this particular facility, out of this cannery. Someone in my family has always been here. There's been a presence from my family. And I don't doubt that. And I like to think that that's actually, you know, that's true. That somebody from my family going back way back when has been affiliated or associated with the advent of the cannery, yeah, in South Neckney. And that's very significant to me. It's significant to my identity, to myself as an Alaska Native growing up in the village of South Neckney. And I would say the identity of the cannery has left its mark on me. You know, it's there. It'll never be taken away from me. And the preservation of the history of this cannery is so incredibly important to myself. I struggle with trying to figure out, you know, how do we do that, Katie? I mean, this is a huge undertaking, and I have so much respect for, you know, the effort that you put forth, you know, to do the historic record keeping for this, for this thing. I hate to call it, you know, something inanimate, because it's not. It was a living thing, mm-hmm, you know, and I think we have a responsibility to the heritage of this cannery to, you know, keep it alive,
yeah,
you know, even if it, you know, just goes back into the earth.
Right.
You know, its soul. We have a responsibility to nurture the soul of the cannery.
Agreed.
Yeah.
Well, great. Is there anything else?
I've pondered how I can contribute to this, Katie, you know, and I didn't want to say anything goofy or, you know, sort of gee whizzy or anything, you know. I just, like yourself, I mean, I just have so many intimate memories of the cannery, you know, getting into mischief. I mean, all kinds of stuff.
Right,
I mean,
right.
You know, really, you know, growing up and then becoming a man and, you know, earning an income to raise my family. I mean, that I have a lot to be thankful for,
mm-hmm.
you know, I've benefited significantly from its existence. I would like to contribute and figure out how to, you know, do my part to keep that memory sustained. You know, I think it's important to do that.
Well, I am just thrilled that you participated mm-hmm. today, and I think we're just getting started.
Good.
So.
All right. Well, so, my dad, Trifon Jr., would love to. He'd love to participate. When I told him that he wanted to go out to lunch today, and I told him I was going to do this, he was like, why didn't you ask me? I was working there for, you know, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, no, we'll get him.
Good.
So, great. Okay, well, thank you.